And my name is Nina Shulman DeGenny. In addition to being the Arab Student Union advisor, I also serve as the manager of transition and ESL here at Marine Valley Community College. I'm so happy to see all of you here today. I know some of you came with your class, and I thank the faculty members that brought their classes today. This is a really informational, educational, and important event that I'm sure by the time you will leave today, you'll be happy that you experienced. I'm really excited that Dr. Sahloul and Ms. Suzanne Akhras Sahloul were able to come today. I had the pleasure of meeting them both a few months back at a conference on refugees, and I was so intrigued by your presentations that you gave, and so connected to the words that you shared that day with everyone, I thought, you have to come to Marine Valley. As the manager of ESL in transition, I also encounter new arrivals from around the world on a daily basis. Many of them in the last couple of years have actually been from Syria, and we have a few of those students here in the audience today. I want to welcome all of our students here today, but a special welcome also to those students that are new arrivals to Marine Valley. We want to make sure that all of students here at Marine Valley, whether you've been in the States your whole life and were born and raised here, or you just arrived in the last few months, that you feel welcome and that you feel like this is a safe, secure environment for you to get your education. And we're happy that you chose our college. I also want to thank the Arab Student Union for hosting this event. I also want to give thanks to the Student Life Office, the Marine Valley Marketing Department, Multimedia Services. They're the ones that supply the mics and get us ready for such events. Our friends like Glenn Carpenter over here taking pictures for us to document these events. Mike Crehan, the faculty members that are here today, Mike McGuire and others that brought their classes today, I really appreciate it. Kevin Navratil, who's not only a professor of political science here at Marine Valley, but also the coordinator of global and diversity education for co-sponsoring with us. We really appreciate that. If you have friends or family, or you happen to be from Syria yourself, I want to invite you to a special session at 1 o'clock. After today's lecture, at 1 p.m., we have a meeting with students that are new arrivals from Syria, or perhaps you have friends or family members that may benefit from the information. And Ms. Suzanne Akhras Sahloul from SAMHS, the Syrian American Medical Society, agreed to stay today to meet with those students and to talk about the services that you'll learn more about in a few minutes. Thank you for agreeing to do that. So I just want to invite you all, if this criteria applies to you, to come to that meeting. It's at 1 p.m. in B260. With that said, I want to hand it over to Kevin. Mr. Kevin Navratil is going to say a few words about international global education. Thank you again, Kevin, for co-hosting with us today.
Thank you, Nina, and thank you again for everybody for coming and braving the elements to be here, and the faculty members for your support. As Nina indicated, I host the Global and Diversity Education Program on campus, and we try to highlight current events and issues to expand international awareness. And if about 4 years ago, I think it was in April, Nina, myself, and another faculty member, Mary Faflis, hosted an event on the Arab Spring, and I could have never envisioned the situation to be so dire as it is today in Syria. So I'm so grateful for you and the Arab Student Union, and of course our gracious speakers, for their willingness to share their insight. I'm very excited about this important event and the implications it has on our local community. So thank you for collaborating on this event. Nora?
Hi, everyone. Thank you. First, I want to thank everyone for coming today. My name is Noor Abdurrahman. I will be introducing Dr. Zahir Sahloul. He is the current president of the Syrian American Medical Society, also known as SAMHS, one of the leading and cutting-edge medical relief organizations serving healthcare needs in Syria during the ongoing humanitarian crisis. Since the beginning of the crisis in Syria more than 3 years ago, SAMHS has been supporting doctors, nurses, and hospitals inside Syria, providing medical and psychological care to Syrian refugees in Lebanon, Jordan, and Turkey, using extreme challenges related to the scale, complexity, poor access, insecurity, and ever-changing face of the crisis. SAMHSA has delivered over $20 million in medical relief to conflict-affected areas inside Syria and neighboring countries. Dr. Sahloul has helped train medical relief workers in topics like medical practice in war zones, dealing with limited resources, and disaster management. He is regularly called on to speak on global health issues related to the Syrian crisis in national news media, on Capitol Hill, and at the White House. His articles appeared on The Lancet, Avicenna, Foreign Policy, New Republic, Policy Review, and Syria Deeply. He helped founding American Relief Coalition for Syria, a coalition of 22 member relief organizations that are providing relief in Syria. He graduated from Damascus University in 1988 and had his training in preliminary critical care and sleep medicine at University of Illinois at Chicago. He has been appointed by Governor Quinn to the Illinois State Board of Health. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Kareem Awad. I'm the ICC representative for ASU. I'll be introducing our second speaker for today. Susan Sahloul is the founder of the Syrian American Medical Society Midwest Foundation, serving as president from 2004 to 2006. She is also one of the founders of SAMHSA National Foundation, serving as national chairwoman from 2005 to 2007. She currently serves as the refugee resettlement coordinator. She served as a board member of Universal School from 2011 to 2013 and was the Council of Islamic Organizations of Greater Chicago, intern and volunteer director from 2011 to 2013. Susan earned her associate's degree from Moraine Valley Community College and her bachelor's degree in history and education from the University of Illinois at Chicago, UIC. She holds a master's of arts in organizational leadership from Lewis University and is currently pursuing a certificate in nonprofit leadership at Kellogg School of Management and certificate in fundraising at Northwestern University. Susan currently resides with her husband and three children in west suburbs of Chicago, and in her spare time, she enjoys reading, hiking, and traveling. Let's please all welcome our first guest speaker, Dr. Zahar Sahloul. Thank you.
Good morning. Do you hear me very well in the back? Assalamu alaikum, marhaba. I'm really honored to be here among you, and I had to interrupt my daily routine. I'm a critical care specialist. I work at Christ Advocate Hospital. So I had morning round. I'm coming here, and then I have to leave early to continue my round. So I apologize if I had to leave early. But I'm excited really to hear the most important part of the presentation, which is my wife's presentation. So I'm just gonna reflect on some of the issues in Syria. And I'm really excited to be here. This is kind of homecoming to us. When I came to Chicago 25 years ago, I lived in an area called Albany Park, some of you are probably familiar with, which is the most diverse area in Chicago. Many immigrants from all over the world, from the Arab world, from Korea, from Mexico, and so forth. And the first Friday after I came to Chicago, my friends brought me to Bridgeview. They said there is a large Arab community over there and you have to come to Bridgeview. So that was my first encounter with this area. After that, after I got married with my wife a couple of years after that, I used to come to Moraine Valley to play soccer. My sons and my wife were graduate of this college. My sons took courses, but they're now in different colleges, but my wife graduated from here. So we feel the connection to this community. I'm going to start with the playing of a documentary about SAMHSA for a few minutes. Then I'm going to have a PowerPoint presentation after that. Thank you.
These are people who the world has given up on, but they have not given up on life. These are the people that just wanted to keep on going, and they make us keep on going as well.
SAMS represents hope through tragedy. The real heroes are the people who are there that no one knows their names. They're there every single day. Some of them have never even had a day off.
SAMS has so much recognition as being the most effective organization in providing medical relief on the ground inside of Syria. And it also has so much recognition as highlighting the work of medical workers and healthcare providers inside of Syria.
When you see the devastation, the degree of destruction that has occurred to the country, and you also see an entire generation now, this has been 4 years, and the impact of what a continual crisis, what a continued civil war, what continued bombing and shelling.
Even little kids playing in the streets would get shot indiscriminately by snipers. So a lot of the injuries we treated were just little kids getting shot in the head, shot in the leg.
You're looking at a lost generation. You have a generation of kids now who know nothing but grief and turmoil, who are working hard with their families as they try to survive.
It's been described as a humanitarian crisis for a good reason. We all know the atrocity that's going on. At this point, we need to look at the future and stop looking at the past and not think of what happened.
بالنسبة للمصابين عمليا نحن بهالمشفى عم نستقبل توقع 60-70 مريض يوميا أحيانا توصل معنا ما يقارب بين يعني 4-5 عمليات كحد أدنى إلى 13-14 عملية باليوم كثير من المرضى عم يحتاجوا عناية مشددة
The field hospitals is the number one. The mobile clinic is a very important thing. You know, we can go inside Syria, whoever's interested.
Our mobile clinics are one of the most innovative responses to the changing situation inside of Syria. There were so many areas where Syrians have been internally displaced, and that keeps on changing. Our mobile clinics are a way to go house to house to provide essential vaccination campaigns, to provide primary care, to provide just all sorts of medical support that's needed.
SAMS is the main organization that doing the work. All the other NGOs are doing a good job. SAMS is carrying the larger scale and the most of the responsibility inside Syria.
The outreach that SAMS does, the advocacy and coordination, participation in coalitions that SAMS does with other NGOs, it really helps amplify both our voice and the voice of those other organizations.
Somehow, we need to change this formula so we can support the organizations, the NGOs that are assisting the people who are in much need. The population in the city of Aleppo, which is the largest city in Syria, need to breathe, need to care about development. The civic society need to work. I urge this committee and all House members to support House Resolution 520 that calls the administration to expand humanitarian assistance and stop the attack on civilians.
The more groups that work together, the clearer it is to policymakers and to the international community that we are working hard and we care and we're not going away.
Regardless of however you may feel politically, the important thing is that this is a humanitarian crisis and a human tragedy that all humans must share in bringing and helping these people out.
We just got word of a barrel bomb outside of Aleppo. And a little boy, 5 years old, named Faris, was playing with his two friends, Mohammed and Rami, and they were severely injured in the barrel bomb attack. His two friends were killed and he was rushed to a SAM-supported hospital. He lost a lot of blood and it seemed like he wasn't going to make it due to his own resilience and to the amazing work of our medical personnel inside of Syria. He was able to pull through. And as the doctors were talking to him and helping him heal after his surgery and ICU care, they asked him, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And he said, "I want to be a doctor so that I can also save Syrian lives. And if I was a doctor, then I would have saved Mohammed and Rami, his two friends who were killed." And that's just one example of hundreds of the kind. Children are being healed by the amazing work of our doctors, and this new generation of Syrians is really being supported.
Shukran Sam. Shukran Sam. Shukran Sam.
Ashkur Sam.
We've had this expanded global community that now works with us. It gives us the hope, it gives us the opportunity to build a better future.
Shukran Sam.
Shukran Sam.
Shukran Sam.
Without SAMs, countless lives would have been lost, and in the future, countless lives would still be lost. Without SAMs, the Syrian medical voice would not be heard inside of Washington, D.C.
Shukran lis-SAMs.
Shukran lis-SAMs.
Shukran lis-SAMs.
I'm going to give a promise from myself and everybody else, you know, who worked with this great organization, that SAMS will be here now and for the Syrian people in the future.
Interested, this documentary is on the website of SAMS. You can look at the whole documentary. And I ended it intentionally on the part that there is a need for advocacy. That was my presentation to the House Foreign Affairs Committee about the humanitarian crisis in Syria. Every person, I believe, should be advocating to end the humanitarian crisis in Syria. This is the worst crisis in our lifetime, in your lifetime, and you have to be vocal about it. Part of the purpose of the presentation of today, according to what I've read from the Student Arab Union Association, is to raise awareness about Syria and the Syrian crisis, and I hope that we can accomplish this tonight. And I'm sure that you are aware of the scale of the crisis. Let me just go over my presentation. So, by the way, this is a presentation to the American College of Cardiology next month, and they have a program called Beyond Medicine, Impact of Climate Change, Pollution, Population, Migration, and War on Populations. And my presentation fits into that because of the climate change, and this is very weird, but is one of the causes of the Syrian crisis and also one of the causes of the Arab Spring. In the Arab world, as you are aware, 65% of people are young people. 65% of the population are young, less than 25 years of age. And many of them are in need for jobs and education. And because of the drought in Syria and other countries like Jordan, there were a huge drought for the past few years that made a huge population shift from the non-urban and the farmland to the central urban areas. And that created a lot of tension. So you have a lot of young people who do not have prospect for jobs and education. And part of the Arab Spring in the beginning was the aspiration of these young people for a better life. But anyway, I will start with this. Do I have a pointer? Or? A picture which I took from the city of Aleppo. I was in a medical mission 3 weeks ago. And they brought me this picture, was drawn by a second grade student from the city of Aleppo. And as you see, it described what children in Aleppo are seeing on a daily basis. So this is if you heard of barrel bomb. This is a barrel bomb. These are barrels stuffed with TNT and thrown in populated areas in city of Aleppo, in Douma, and other cities like Deir ez-Zor and Homs in Syria. And as you see, you have the impact of the barrel bombs on the children. You in the hospital that I went to, you had many children who are victims of this, who come with amputations, who come with huge injuries, who require surgery, and unfortunately some of them are dead, don't make it. Last year was a year that is special because for the first time since the Second World War, we had more than 51 million displaced people in the world, 51 million people in the world. Syria is number one in terms of refugees right now, surpassed Afghanistan. Syria is also number one in boat migrants. These are people who take the boat going to Europe from areas in the Middle East, and some of them unfortunately are drowned. We had five level three disasters last year, including Syria, Iraq, Central African Republic, South Sudan, and Philippines. We had also the Ebola outbreak, as you know. So Syria is considered level three emergency, which is the highest level of emergencies. And this, you know, I go over this slide every time I have presentation, and I have to adjust it, because every week and every month we have increased numbers. So this is the numbers from last week. More than 230,000 people in Syria were killed, 1 million people, and this is an estimate, probably it's higher than that, were injured. 12.2 million people in Syria are in need. The population of Syria is 22 million. 3.8 million are registered refugees, 3.8 million, according to the UNHCR. And the number of refugees is much higher than this number, but these are the registered ones. 7.6 million are internally displaced people inside Syria. 4.7 million are in areas are difficult to reach inside Syria. 800,000 are in completely besieged areas, and I'll show you some pictures of the impact of the siege on these population. And 5.5 million children are affected by the crisis. This picture, and I apologize for the graphic picture, is the children who died on August 21st, 2013, when a chemical weapon attack happened in East Ghouta. I'm sure that some of you are familiar with it. This is when sarin gas was used to gas the population while they were asleep. More than 1,400 people were killed during that night. This is Dr. Abdelaziz, one of the heroes that you've heard about in the documentary. He's a surgeon, general surgeon in Aleppo, who is overseeing the crisis management and disaster management in some of the hospitals that are still working in Aleppo. I was in this visiting Aleppo a few months ago, and I was planning to go to this hospital when I was told in the morning, don't come because we had barrel bomb attacking the hospitals. So I came in the afternoon, and this is some of the aftermath of the barrel bombing. And you see Dr. Abdelaziz carrying this bag, and I will quiz you about this bag at the end of this presentation. And he's looking at the wreckage. He's trying to identify if there is any salvageable surgical sets or equipment that he can use for treating the patients in other hospitals. For some reason, and this is unique for the Syrian crisis, that the medical community were targeted, were attacked. And as you know, attacking physicians, attacking ambulances, attacking hospitals is war crime. The international community have decided more than 150 years ago that physicians should have the right to treat their own patients, even in the time of conflict, even if they are treating civilians or soldiers who belong to the other party. But this is not respected in Syria, and because of that, we had a systematic attack on the healthcare system in Syria, which led to the flight of 50% of the doctors in Syria, according to the World Health Organization. 50% of Syrian doctors, or about 15,000, have fled Syria. This is not Moses leading his group through the sea, but this is one of the large refugee community who are fleeing from Syria to Iraq. This is a Kurdish Syrians group who are passing the Nahar Dijla, they call it, the river of Dijla or Tigris, from Syria to Iraq when the gate was opened. Many times you have these trapped Syrians who want to flee for safety reasons, from areas in Syria to either Turkey or Iraq or Lebanon or Jordan. These are the neighboring countries. And this is one of the pictures when they were allowed to go to Iraq a few months ago. This is another picture of a recent flight of refugees from the city of Ain al-Arab, or Kobani, if you heard it in the news. This is also a Kurdish city in northern Syria. And ISIS, or Daesh in Arabic, was attacking the city, and this is the impact of that. So you had a large group of Kurdish Syrians who are trying to flee to Turkey this time. Where's this picture from? This is from Al-Za'atari. Za'atari camp is the second largest refugee camp in the world. It is located in Jordan, northern Jordan, and so far we had about 170,000 refugees settled in Al-Za'atari camp. This Al-Za'atari camp was established only 2 years ago. The first refugee camp in the world is in Kenya. I visited Al-Za'atari camp, and I'll show you some pictures of the of Al-Camp. This is one of the pictures of Al-Za'atari camp. Of course, when we see these numbers, 3.8 million refugees, these pictures of a huge camp, sometimes you do not look at the human face of the crisis. You just worry about the numbers. We started a few years ago with 10,000 refugees. Now we are 3.8 million refugees. When we attend conferences in the United Nations about humanitarian crisis, people start to recite numbers, and numbers do not mean anything. What's more important is to understand that beyond these numbers, you have the children, you have the women, you have the elderly who are in these camps. And 75% of the refugees and internally displaced people are women and children. Women and children. 50% of the refugees are children. These are some of the children which I've seen in my first mission to Turkey 4 years ago. The Syrian crisis started in March of 2011. So that was our first medical mission to Turkish refugee camps. And these are two children who were brought. We had a clinic there in the camp. And they were brought to us because they had bed wetting problem at night. Most of the children and the women and elderly in the refugee camps are traumatized. And bed wetting is one of the symptoms of psychological trauma. This is a more recent trip to Al-Za'atari camp. I saw this child sitting in Al-Za'atari camp. We have a polyclinic, a clinic in Al-Za'atari camp that sees 500 patients every day. So we have a group of 10 physicians and nurses. We have a lab and radiology lab. And they were waiting in the waiting area. And I saw this kid, and I took his picture. This is to quantify the attacks on healthcare in Syria. There is an organization called Physicians for Human Rights that counts the number of attacks on healthcare professionals in Syria. It is based in Boston, in the United States, and so far they documented 599 medical personnel were killed in Syria, 90% by government forces. They documented more than 195 attacks on medical facilities in 2014 only. This is one of their maps, and if you can go to their website, PHR, and you can click on some of these dots, and it will detail to you the incident, the details of the incidents, how many people were killed, and sometimes they have pictures on YouTube and videos. Again, this is a picture of the M1 hospital in Aleppo that was attacked by barrel bombs, and this is Dr. Abdulaziz. And these are some of the other victims of the attacks, which is medical instruments. This is Al-Kindi Medical Center, which is the largest medical center in northern Syria. Cost the Syrian people about $300 million. Used to be the only center for radiation therapy in the city of Aleppo. This is the same center after being bombed by the fighting parties, by the government and also the fighting parties. I took this picture myself. And you see on the right side of the screen a ventilator that we use here for to save life. And you cannot use it in Syria because it was bombed. Ambulances are something that is very sacred in the war. So the ICRC, International Committee for the Red Cross, recommends that actually you use the emblem of ICRC, either the Red Cross or the Red Crescent, on ambulances or hospitals to prevent your ambulance or your hospital from being attacked. This is not the case in Syria. Actually, if you use these emblems, you will be attacked. usually by the government forces, but sometimes by the other fighting parties. And this is one of the ambulances that was attacked also in the same hospital that I showed you. This is the impact of barrel bomb on one of the neighborhoods in the on the city of Aleppo. Aleppo is the largest city in Syria in terms of population. It's a huge metropolitan center. It's it's on the Silk Road. It's a center for trade and commerce in Syria. In the eastern side of Aleppo, which is under the control of the rebels, most of the population have fled Aleppo. So you see whole neighborhoods that are empty, like ghost towns. This is one of them, and this is because of the impact of barrel bombs. The Human Rights Watch has documented in a detailed report the impact of barrel bombs on civilian areas in the city of Aleppo. And what they have said, which is very interesting, that barrel bombs are thrown in civilian areas, not on the front line. I think the reason for that there is intentional reason for the Syrian government to let the people flee from areas that are under control of the rebels. Some of the victims of barrel bombs, these were taken by my friend and classmate, who's an orthopedic surgeon in M10 hospitals. Unfortunately, the child on the right side did not make it. The child on the left side made it. You go to emergency room and hospitals in the city of Aleppo and Douma and Homs and Deir ez-Zor and northern Latakia, and you see these pictures on a daily basis. These are traumatized children that sometimes they lose their limbs because they require amputation. Sometimes they lose their eyes. Sometimes they have spinal cord injury. Many times they end up with a lifelong psychological trauma. Psychological support is not very common in Syria, like any other developing countries. And you have 65% of the refugees and internally displaced people in one of the surveys have psychiatrical trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder. This is an article which I wrote in Foreign Policy about sniper attacks. And sometimes lately there was this discussion about American Sniper, the movie that did not win in the Oscar. In Syria, there are Syrian snipers. In one of the neighborhoods in the city of Aleppo, there is an area called Ma'bar al-Maut, the corridor of death, where snipers usually sit on a tall building and they shoot at the civilians who are passing from area to area. I've seen some of the victims. Dr. Nolte from England, who's a trauma surgeon, world-renowned, spent 1 month in the city of Aleppo, and he documented what he sees in the hospital. And what he said that, these snipers play games every day because they have to sit down for a long time. They've been doing that for a long time. So sometimes they shoot only at children. So he said from the morning you would know what's the pattern for the rest of the day. Sometimes they shoot at pregnant women. Sometimes they shoot at the right side of the chest. So from the morning, the physician will know if everyone came with the right side injury, then the rest of the day you will have right side injury. And sometimes they have bets, and sometimes they shoot at cats and dogs. Thank you. What we do in SAMS that we provide support for physicians inside Syria, and we also provide medical and health care for refugees in Lebanon and Jordan and Turkey. So we have polyclinics in Jordan and Lebanon and Turkey. We have dental clinics. We have psychosocial program in Jordan and Lebanon. And inside Syria, we support these trauma hospitals and field hospitals. We do training for physicians. We send them medical supplies through Turkey and Jordan. So we do what's called cross-border medical relief. This hospital, which I'm showing a picture from, is SAMS Hospital in the city of Aleppo. It was bombed 3 times. So last time it was built underground, but it is fully equipped, and you have surgeons and nurses who actually live and eat and sleep in the same place. It is well protected right now, and this is one of the surgeries on the victims of snipers. This other hospital that also supported partially by SAMS went there a few months ago, and the medical director of the hospital told me, we would like you to send us medical supplies. And I said, what else you would need? He said, everything. Send us oral antibiotics, send us gloves, send us gowns, and also send us body bags because we don't have more body bags. In Syria also you have chemical weapons. So imagine developing countries in the crisis now for 4 years, where you have war, you have trauma, where you have bombs, you have missiles, but also children and civilians have to worry about chemical weapons. So the international organization that documents chemical weapons documented the use of chlorine gas in the last year. But in the year before, there was a use of nerve gas, sarin gas. And you go to some of the areas in Syria and you see these instructions in Arabic that tells you what to do when you have an attack with sarin gas. So imagine that you are displaced already, you moved probably from your city to another village, to another place, you are living in a tent, but you also have to worry about chemical weapons. In areas that are under siege in Syria, there is shortage of everything, including food and baby milk. In Al-Ghouta, which is an area around Damascus, one of the most fertile areas in Syria, there is siege for the past 850 days by, unfortunately, government forces. The area of Al-Ghouta is under the control of the rebels. And we had documented cases of children dying because of malnutrition. This is one of them. Where is this picture from? Yarmouk camp. Yarmouk camp is a Palestinian refugee camp in Syria. As you know, Syria is neighboring the Holy Land, Palestine, and we had large Palestinian refugees in Syria. Yarmouk camp is in the heart of Damascus, the capital of Syria. It used to have 500,000 Syrian refugees, Palestinian refugees who came after the 1967 war. So most of them were born inside Syria, second and third and fourth generation. And it was under complete siege by the government, and they allowed, when this picture taken, the United Nations agency to enter the camp. That was last year, and this is, was the picture was taken when the population came because they wanted some to have food rations from the United Nations agencies. This is one of the picture of a neighborhood of Al-Hajar al-Aswad. This is not, I mean, when I describe this picture, I tell students that this is not from Auschwitz, this is from Syria in the 21st century. We had an epidemic of polio in Syria after it was extinct for 14 years. So when you go through O'Hare Airport, you have this guy, Bill Gates, saying that we are that close to eradicate polio. Because of the crisis in Syria and because of decreased vaccination of children in some areas, which went down from 95% to 30%, we had an epidemic of polio. More than 110 cases were documented, but fortunately, because of the work of several NGOs and the collaboration with the Turkish Red Crescent, there was a huge campaign, a vaccination campaign with 8 rounds. SAMS participated in the campaign, and since January of last year, we had no more cases of polio. But we have other infectious diseases that are now spreading in Syria. We have an epidemic of Leishmania, which is a skin disease. We have an epidemic of hepatitis A. We have an epidemic of scabies and lice, unfortunately, because there is no clean water, and some other infectious diseases. This is a picture from a field hospital that is done in the basement, established in the basement of a cultural center in northern Latakia. We have to do that to protect the physicians and the patients, to do it in areas that are either protected naturally or we build it underground. In some of the areas, the Doctors Without Borders had established field hospitals in natural caves because it's protected naturally. I would like to end with this picture. This is a picture from a emergency room in Aleppo, and if you are a patient going to that emergency room, you will see what you see in any emergency room here. So you have exam table, you have ambu bags, you have defibrillator, IV fluid, but also you have sandbags. Thank you very much for having us, and I'm looking forward to hear the presentation of my wife. And this is a picture from Al-Za'atari camp from outside. Thank you.
I'm really happy to be here. I want to thank Kevin, Suha, Razan, Nina, and the Arab Student Union for organizing this event. Thank you so much for doing all the work. And I want to give a special shout out to one of my students, Sahar al-Najjar. When I was in Universal School, when I was part of the board, I taught the environmental club after school, and Sahar was one of the most active students there. So thank you for coming, Sahar. as my who read my bio? Karim read my bio. I serve as the SAMS Refugee Resettlement Coordinator. As you know, with the exploding population of Syrian refugees, the State Department has allowed that Syrian refugees to be resettled here in the United States. And so far, they have approved about 10,000 refugees to be resettled here. And just because they've allowed or they've approved 10,000 for 2015 does not mean that they're all here. They're in the pipeline, but there are some families who have been resettled in the United States, and there are a few families who have been resettled here in Chicago. So United States, we have a long tradition of resettling refugees, and we are the most successful in the world in refugee resettlement. And what is a refugee? A refugee is someone who's been forced to flee their country because of war or political reasons, and they're usually registered by the UNHCR. And an asylum seeker, I know that there are many asylum seekers here in the United States who are Syrian, and they usually meet the definition of what a refugee is, that they're fleeing persecution, they're already in the U.S., and they're seeking admission through a port of entry, and they have, or sometimes they come in as a student, on a student visa or on a travel visa, and then they end up applying for asylum so they can stay in the United States. We started resettling refugees after World War II, and basically the word refugee did not come into existence until 1980. And then after the Vietnam War, we resettled many South Asian refugees here in the United States. Since 1975, we have resettled over 3 million refugees. That's a huge number. And like I said, the U.S. has a long tradition of resettling refugees. And in 2013, we resettled 70,000. And who gets to decide on the number of refugees that get to be resettled here? It's the President of the United States. And he consults with Congress and the State Department on the appropriate number. People have to be registered with the UNHCR in order for them to be resettled. They cannot come to the United States as refugees unless they're resettled with the UNHCR. And how the resettlement process works is that there are nine refugee resettlement agencies. They're called VOLAGs, which stands for Voluntary Agency. And these nine VOLAGs, they meet once a week and they discuss and they see where what states or what cities can receive the most refugees. And usually they work in partnerships with the Office of the Department of Health and Human Services. And each state has a Department of Health and Human Services. So some of these VOLAGs are Church World Services, Hebrew Immigration Aid Society, International Rescue Committee, and these are the rest, U.S. Committee on Refugee and Immigrants, World Relief. And many of these resettlement agencies have satellite offices throughout the United States. They have over 350 affiliates. They get funding at the national level. They get about $1,800 per refugee, and that funding goes towards their housing, purchasing furniture for them, clothing, and as well as some of the expenses that go along with as they enter the United States. And at the state level also, each refugee gets about $1,100. In the state of Illinois, the monetary assistance lasts about eight months. Now, different states have different requirements, but in the state of Illinois, usually up to 8 months that refugees receive assistance. Refugees can apply for a green card after 1 year, and they're eligible to work. And they need to be supported and connected to services, obviously. Now we're talking about refugees coming to be resettled here in the United States, but let's not forget that Syrians have migrated to the United States for about 100 years now. The first wave of Syrian immigration was in the late 19th century. Mainly came from Damascus, Aleppo, and Homs. They were mainly Christian and Jewish Syrians that immigrated. And they came into big cities like New York, Boston, Detroit, and New Jersey. And the second wave of Syrian immigration to the United States was in the 1960s. That's when my dad came to the U.S. He came to, he was here in Northwestern University. He studied engineering, and that's where he met my mother. My mother's not Syrian, she's Canadian, but she was here to study college, and she was in school, and they met, and So there are many Syrians that came in this wave in the 1960s, and they were the professional class that came in at that time. And now this third wave of Syrians that will be coming to the United States, and they will be asylum seekers and refugees. So Syrians are known to be educated. They come from urban areas. They are very well known in the Arab world for their skilled labor, for their hospitality and service sectors. They're very hospitable. They're generous, friendly, resilient, hardworking, and they make the best food. But I could be biased, of course. So I'm sure you've heard of tabbouli, hummus, kibbeh, baba ghanoush. All these are, of course, and all the yummy food, right? Under SAMS, we created a group called Syrian Community Network. And we hope to, we formed this committee so that we can support refugees and asylees as they're coming to the United States. We're partnering up with refugee agencies here in Chicago, agencies like Refugee One, Heartland Alliance, World Relief, and Catholic Charities. We want to gather that information and that data about new Syrians as they come in. We want to develop an intake process and then gather resources so that we can make referrals. And we are trying to communicate with people, try to bring awareness and let them know about our group through Facebook and through Twitter and website and all these different awareness campaigns. And we want to put together programs. And this is where Maureen Valley can help in these types of programs. We want to develop an adoptive family program, a tutoring program from college students like yourselves who can go into their homes and then help tutor their children. We want to do volunteer training. We are doing cultural awareness for both the case managers at the refugee agencies, and we want to do cultural awareness for the Syrians as they come in. Different habits, different ways of saying hello, different things, so that when they enter the United States, they know how to interact with the other. And we want to focus also on mental health counseling because many of these refugees are coming in with a lot of trauma. They've been through many things. Yesterday, I was visiting one of the newly resettled refugees. They live out in Evanston, and they were telling me the one of the daughters, she's in eighth grade. She was talking about how when the rockets fell in their home, she had a shrapnel on her shoulder, and she was telling me how their family. She still remembers the sounds of the shrapnel coming in, and how her family all ran and took her to the hospital, and so they can operate on her. So this is a trauma that she's carrying around with her. And even her younger sister, she remembers her sister bleeding and all the chaos that happened. So this is something that they're carrying inside of them, so we want to make sure that they are able to seek those the help and the services that they need. We want to develop women and girls programs. We want to develop financial understanding workshops because, in Syria, usually the way you pay the bills is that you have a bill collector that knocks on your door and then asks for you to pay your water bill. Now, coming to the United States, it's a completely different system. So we want to build that understanding also. And we want to do back-to-school programs and nutrition and many, many services that refugees and asylees will need as they come in and assimilate and acclimate in their new environment. So our mission is to empower Syrian refugees in achieving a seamless transition and relocation to the United States through connecting people to the right services and support networks. Our vision is that we envision a matured wave. Like I said, I mentioned the first wave of Syrian refugees, and then the second wave. The first wave was in the late 19th century. The second wave was in the 60s, the professional class that came in. And now this would be the third significant wave of Syrian immigration to the United States. So why is it important to work with refugees? It's important to welcome newcomers. They want to have a sense of belonging. We want to help ease that transition. Refugees are like you and me. They're no different. They celebrate birthdays and have anniversaries, and they have feelings, and they want to be involved, and they want to be part of the community. They want to be productive members in the community because they want to find jobs, and they want to earn money and so that they can take care of their families. And everyone deserves a chance. And I want to really thank you again. Our email here is info@syriancommunity.org. Feel free to email me or call me for anything that you would like. I know all of you now will probably be graduating from Maureen Valley soon, and then you look to go to the four-year university. And we want you to stay with us and connect with us so that if we build that tutoring program or if we build that adopt-a-family or mentorship program, we want you to be involved. So this is why it's so important to have all of you here, and it's so important to to connect with us so that we can work together and that we can help people as they come in and welcome them and make them feel like they're part of our family also. Thank you so much.
Good afternoon, everyone. I hope everyone learned something today. I'd like to thank Dr. Suzanne and Dr. Zahed for coming here. You know, we're always proud to have people who can inform us more about our Arabian culture and serious issues going on in the Middle East. Of course, I just want to highlight that if anyone wants to learn more information about SAMS and their services, you guys can go to B260 at 1 p.m. today. We're going to be, informing everyone more about this SAMS and their services. Also, to join ASU, you know, we're always looking for new members who can join the club and get a taste of our culture. And, you know, we want to teach them more about our initiatives that we're involved in. You guys are free to join us Fridays in room 209, that's in the U building on the second floor at 1 p.m. You guys are more than welcome. I just really want to thank my board, you know, Bilal Shuli, Karim Awad, Noor Abdulrahman, and of course our advisors, Nina Shomandajani and Suha Muhammad. For right now, I just want to pass the mic to Bilal Shuli, who's going to be starting the Q&A. I think he has something to say right now. So I hope you guys learned something, and we're looking forward for everyone to join us.
Hello, how's everybody doing? My name is Bilal Shuli. I'm the treasurer of the ASU. So right before we go into the Q&A, I just have a little spill I want to, you know, share with you guys. I'm a Palestinian Jordanian. This is my second semester in Rain Valley. I'm an international student. When I came here, just like everyone else, when they leave where they've been at for a long time, they try to go somewhere where they can find a sense of belonging, a sense where they feel like they belong in that certain particular place, or to feel like they can achieve comfortably without feeling like they're ostracized by society or anything like that. So when I came here, the ASU accommodated all my worries and realized that we can actually do something with a limited number of students, whether it was a limited funds. You can always try, you can always achieve. And today, I guess, was living proof to what we were able to do. So thank you guys for coming out, and let's move into the Q&A. So whoever has a question, please raise your hand. I'll pass the mic for our speakers, of course. Right there.
Actually, it's not a dumb question. It's a very important question, because many times when we hear about Syria right now, we hear about ISIS, we hear about jihadists, we hear about all of these things, but no one knows how did this start. And it started as part of the Arab Spring, when people started to demonstrate because they wanted to have a better life, they wanted to have democracy, they wanted to have freedoms, like what happened in Egypt, in Tahrir Square, like what happened in Yemen and other, and Tunisia and so forth. The Syrian regime responded to these demonstrations with extreme brutality. So they had snipers shooting at the demonstrators. They had snipers shooting at children, the demonstrators. And the first 9 months of called sometimes the Syrian Revolution, or what we call it in humanitarian circles, the crisis, were completely peaceful, where you have demonstrations in Homs, in Damascus, in other cities, Hama. Some of you probably familiar with the largest demonstration which happened in the city of Hama, where you had 500,000 people. We had our ambassador, the American ambassador, and the French ambassador attending that peaceful demonstration. Because of the extreme brutality that the Syrian government responded to these demonstrations, because they did not want to change. Assad was interviewed by Wall Street Journal 2 months before the first demonstration, and they asked him, aren't you worried that the same thing that happened in Egypt and Tunisia will happen in Syria? He said, no way. Syrians are better than that, and Syrians like me, and Syrians don't want change. So definitely he had different perspective. By the way, he had a recent interview with BBC, and it looks like he had the same perspective. In spite of the whole destruction of the country and so forth, he still think that he should be the president of Syria. And he had an election last year where he won the election by 90%. So the reason that the people started to carry arm and fight the government is because the government responded by killing people in these demonstrations. And then you had a civil war that started in some cities and then spread it throughout Syria. Because of the void that was created by the international community, lack of response to the crisis, then you had the extremists coming and exploiting the void that was created and the chaos that was created. What can you do? I think this is very important. Of course, you can volunteer to any of the organizations that are providing humanitarian assistance to Syria, and there are many of them. SAMS is one of them. If you are interested in helping refugees, we have now a platform to help local refugees who are coming and settling in Chicago. So you have that also. If you like to be advocate for the Syrian people, then I think that would be important. And you can contact your congressman, you can contact your senator. It's easy, and I think it's very powerful, and it's underused. Do not underestimate your power. As a student, I think you can organize also a group of students. Maybe you start with a letter writing campaign. Just write to Senator Durbin. Senator Durbin is very powerful in D.C. He's the second in command in the Democratic Party. And tell him, as American, I cannot sit down while seeing these pictures coming from Syria. We have to do something to end the crisis. Our administration, unfortunately, was not very proactive in ending the crisis. We provided a lot of humanitarian assistance, $3.5 billion, which is great and appreciated, but we can do much more to end the crisis and make sure that we have a political transition in Syria.
If you don't mind just repeating the question, Dr. Sahloul, yes. Just to make sure it gets picked up on the recording, please repeat the question that the students ask. Thank you. Yes, Susan.
First of all, thank you for being here. Thank you for all of your hard work and for informing us about what's going on in Syria. My name is Suzanne, and my question is, in addition to the $3.5 billion that the United States has given in humanitarian support, can you say a little bit more about what other role can the U.S. play in helping to end the crisis?
We are still the most powerful country in the world. And there's a lot of things that our administration can do to force the Syrian government to accept political settlement. That's what everyone talks about. I'm not a politician, but over the past 4 years, I've been talking to too many people, including people in the higher power in the United Nations. And what they are saying that in Syria, to end the crisis, we have to have a political transition that satisfies the aspirations of the Syrian people. That means you have to have a compromise. That means the Syrian government and Assad has to accept that they have to leave. And then they have a power-sharing agreement. The only way to force that, force the Syrian government to accept that, is by making sure that they don't believe that they will win militarily. Right now, they think that they will win by bombing areas and bombing civilians and emptying areas from their population. And we can do that by supporting, for example, what Turkey and Qatar and Saudi Arabia were saying. Why don't we have a protected or safe zone or no-fly zone in some areas in Syria where these helicopters and fighter jets cannot throw bombs on population? If we enforce that, and we can enforce that, especially in northern Syria, then that will allow the refugees to come back. That will prevent the Syrian government from bombing areas and destroying cities and so forth. It will allow the civic society to work and focus on development and creating jobs and so forth. And it will change the dynamics on the ground and make sure that the Syrian regime will accept a political settlement. That's the only way. We have to do that, of course, with our allies in the Arab world and the region.
I just wanted to thank you for not only the informative presentation, but the actual work that you do on the ground in Syria and helping the refugees. I mean, it's amazing, the helping your fellow human beings. And I just wanted to ask, with the refugees, you spoke very highly of the United States response, but it seems like 3 million over a 40-year period, it seems like some countries are doing more as far as taking in refugees. But yet I also am aware that there's some in the United States who are very concerned about new refugees coming in. There's a House of Representative from Texas, I think Mike McCall, who's been very critical of the Obama administration taking anybody else or additional refugees specifically from Syria. So how, I guess if you could speak to that as far as that maybe domestic concern about security related in some way to ISIS versus actually helping the humanitarian refugees assimilate and have a safe place to be.
I mean, definitely, this is something that you hear from some of the members of the Congress. Maybe my wife will comment on this issue. By the way, Senator Durbin is one of the leading voices for refugee rights and for immigrants' rights, of course. And we were part of the coalition to support immigrants' rights here in the United States. But and he was vocal to resettle Syrian refugees in Syria early in the crisis. So you have these two arguments that we have to do our duty to settle Syrian refugees. Right now you have 3.8 million refugees in the neighboring countries around Syria, but United States should receive more of what received. So far we have received only a few hundreds from the 3.8 million. On the other hand, Germany received 30,000 Syrian refugees. Sweden has received about 15,000, and per capita Sweden is probably the highest. We met with their UN envoy, and he was bragging that we are the first country that received Syrian refugees. So definitely we can do more. And this is a political decision. And if you send to your congressman and your senator that we would like to settle more Syrian refugees, and we're talking about 75% of the refugees being children and women. These are not ISIS. I mean, these are people who are living in tents for 3 and 4 years. And I think it's our duty as the most wealthy country in the world to resettle some of them. President Obama has made the decision to resettle 70,000 Syrians over the next few years, but the process is very slow. And I think with a little bit of advocacy, we can expedite that. Your advocacy should be directed to the administration, that means to President Obama. You can send letters to the White House or emails, and you can send it also to your congressmen and your senators so they know that we are hospitable people. We are open to settle refugees who are in need.
I also want to add that if you look at the history of Syrian immigration to the United States, whenever Syrians have come into the U.S., they have been very successful. And in general, most refugee populations, when they come into the U.S., they revive communities, they revive depressed areas. If you Somalia has one of the most successful resettlement programs in the country. They had a report, an article about the governor, about the amount of jobs that they have created and the infrastructure and all of the businesses that they have opened. So if Syrian refugees or other refugees come to the United States, they revive economies, they open businesses. Last year, I was invited to by the Lutheran Services to Omaha, and they were talking about the how much the Burmese refugees have done for the community in Omaha, that they have now, not only have they worked for several years, but now they're actually buying homes. So that is helping the city of Omaha also to revive its own economy. So I know that if Syrians come here, they have a long history. They're very entrepreneurial. They're very hardworking. They want to succeed. And yesterday when I was visiting with two families, they were just talking about, we can't wait to start a job. We can't wait to do this. The oldest son is now, he's 18, but he doesn't have a high school diploma, but he wants to start GED. And they're very excited and motivated to work. Usually in Syrian culture, and anyone, and probably I think from most Arab cultures, when a child comes home and says, you know, mom, dad, I got a 90 on my test, I'm so happy. The parent, what would they tell them? Well, why didn't you get 100? And this is how most Syrians are. And if my daughter comes home, tells me I got 100, I tell her, why didn't you get the extra credit right also? So this is this is our culture. This is the way we are. Syrians always place high value on education. And I know that if they do come into the U.S., they will reap the benefits of being here. And I believe that they will open new businesses and be very much part of the community. They are women and men and children and elderly and you know, very loving people, and they just want an opportunity.
Let me just end, if there's no more questions, with two examples of success of Syrian immigrants to the United States. First one is previous governor of Indiana, Mitch Daniels. He's the grandson of a Syrian immigrant, and actually he still have family in a small village called Qalat al-Husn in Syria. He has a foundation that supports some of the ventures there. This is not something that well known. And the second one is everyone is aware of is your iPhone. The person who invented your iPhone, Steve Jobs, is the son of Syrian immigrant. His father is his name is Abdel Fattah al-Jindali, who unfortunately gave him for adoption when he was younger. But the iPhone and the iPad is the fruits of also Syrian immigrants. By the way, Syrians, like many other Arabs, they're very proud people, and they believe that they are the origin of civilizations. The first alphabet was invented in Syria. The first colors, the first music were invented in Syria. We believe that we are the sons of John the Baptist. He's buried in Damascus. The sons of Salah al-Din Ayyubi, he's a Kurdish hero who's buried also in Damascus, and the sons of Imam Hussein. So there is a huge history in Syria that goes 5,000, 6,000 years. And if you're interested to read more about Syrian heritage and civilization, I think that will be very intriguing for you. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. I know that many of you have to run to class. Again, a reminder, if you're interested in learning more about SAMHSA and their services, join us at 1 p.m. in B260. Thank you.